My name is Paul Weber. Dr. Michelle Alpha has been both a teleclass faculty and a teleclass participant. She is well known and respected for her research in the microbiology of reprocessing, and she publishes and writes frequently on the topic. She is possibly one of the most fun people to hang around with and a really neat lady. So to give the teleclass, Cleaning Reusable Medical Devices, I am absolutely delighted to present Dr. Michelle Alpha. Michelle.
Well, thanks for that introduction, Paul. I'm not sure how I can carry on after that one. Paul and I have been caught in a rainstorm at one meeting, and you get to know people a lot when you share umbrellas with them. So on that note, we'll stop. But in today's session, what I would like to do is review with you some of the issues about cleaning of reusable medical devices. And many of the pieces of information I'm going to talk about, you may be very familiar with. And I'm hoping that as we go through the session today, it will raise some issues that you would like to hear addressed or discussed. And I'd be more than willing, if you've got examples of cleaning issues that you've had problems with, that would be a great opportunity for us to be able to discuss them. Basically, what I'm hoping to try to do today is talk about the cleaning of reusable medical devices and identify what are the reprocessing challenges for medical devices that are currently used in healthcare setting in hospitals and how can these be addressed. By training, I'm a clinical microbiologist, but I spent a long time with our infection control practitioners and with the people that do the reusable reprocessing in our institution. And I have to be honest with you, you folks see this on a daily basis. When I first started getting involved in research in this area, I was quite amazed by the types of medical devices that are out there that are being used and the apparent lack of consideration to cleaning when these devices were originally developed. So if you go to the second slide, the overview of what I hope to address in today's telesession is I'd like to cover some of the basic cleaning concepts. And although this seems very simplistic, I believe we need to start at that point and address what are the key points that each institution needs to take into consideration when they are deciding how they're going to clean their medical devices. The second part of what I would like to address is an overview of what some of the medical device issues are. And I know from the research I've done with some difficult-to-clean medical devices, if you look at a device, sometimes it's very hard to appreciate the complexity of where does fluid flow in that device. And I'd like to give you, I guess, some hints or some suggestions for as you're working through the process of identifying cleaning methods for medical devices, what are the types of things you need to keep in mind when you're making those kinds of decisions. And then finally, I'd like to touch on the impact of suboptimal cleaning. Why are we concerned about it, and is it a real issue, is it important, or is it just that we're making a tempest in a teapot, and in reality, it doesn't really matter how clean we get these devices or not. So that will be the overview for today's session, and I hope that if I at least stimulate a few new thoughts in your mind by the time we're finished, I will have done my job of trying to raise some of these issues, because I know each and every one of you are directly involved in some of the decision-making processes or some of the issues that come up in your institution. If you go to the third slide, the next slide in the presentation, it's entitled, What is Proper Reprocessing? And that sounds pretty simplistic. The first stage in the reprocessing would, of course, be the cleaning of it. And that is broken down, in my opinion, into physical removal of any patient secretions or organisms that may be on the device. It's affected by the detergent you choose. It's affected by the temperature at which you do the cleaning. And it most certainly is affected by how well the rinsing is done and the quality of water that is used for rinsing. When you clean, there's no way that you remove 100% of all of the organisms that are there or necessarily all of the patient's soil. The game plan is to get as much of that off as is humanly possible. And you're going to see as I go through my presentation, there needs to be a recognition that each and every time this is done, the goal is to try to do the best job every time, because if you don't, that's where problems occur. The second stage in proper reprocessing would be the disinfection or sterilization stage, and that's obviously related to the fact that you've done the best job you can for cleaning, you've removed as much as you can and you've rinsed it, and now what you want to do is properly disinfect or sterilize the medical device so that it's safe to use in the next procedure on the next patient. And that part of the reprocessing is the killing of any residual organisms that might remain on the device so that the device is now sterile if that's what the device requires. And if it is a critical device that's entering a sterile body cavity, then of course it needs to be sterilized in between patient use. If it's something like a flexible endoscope, it's a semi-critical device and it would need to have a minimum of high-level disinfection between patient use. If it's a non-critical device like a bedpan, obviously the disinfection or sterilization that's done on something like that is basically to make it safe to handle and safe to then put back and use on another patient. If you click to the next slide is entitled The Cleaning Process. And I want to take a bit of time going over the cleaning process because there are issues here that have an impact on how effective the cleaning is, and we often don't spend a lot of time to think about them. The first in the cleaning process is really the pre-rinse. It really is important that the gross debris or soil is removed, and every one of you in your institutions, I know, have things like this in place. With flexible endoscopes at the patient bedside, they would be suctioned with water or enzymatic detergent to remove the gross soil from within the endoscope. In any of the surgical cases, the first thing that's done when those case carts come out is the pre-rinse to remove the gross debris. The second bullet on that slide is directed toward the detergent or the cleaning agent that's being used. And the cleaning agent could be a chemical, which means that it is much like our chemicals that we would use as a cleaning agent in a dishwashing detergent, if you will. And I'm using that analogy because I want to make sure that we separate into two groups, the types of detergent. One group are chemicals, where the chemical itself is facilitating the removal of the soil. The other group of detergents are those called enzymatic detergents. And enzymatic detergents, the active ingredient in them, the enzyme, they're actually proteins. And those proteins have a biological function, which is to, for instance, a protease would degrade protein, et cetera. And I think one of the things that is often forgotten is that those enzymes themselves are a form of protein, and if the enzyme detergent isn't adequately rinsed off of the device, you have now coated your device with a layer of protein, which is the enzyme detergent itself. Now, the issues of removal of the detergent are the same for both chemical and enzymatic detergents. It's important that either of those are adequately removed before the device is sterilized or disinfected, and certainly before patient use. But the difference between them is enzymatics are proteins, and if you were to put a device coated with enzymatic detergent into a high-level disinfectant such as glutaraldehyde, you're now fixing that enzyme onto the surface of your medical device. So when I emphasize the removal of detergents, that's the reason I'm emphasizing it. You want to make sure that you don't inadvertently fix those enzymes onto the device. The next bullet deals with sonication. And to me, there's very high-tech terms of defining what sonication is, the implosion models, et cetera. I like to take the layman's approach to it, and sonication is basically a means of physically knocking soil off the device surface. So if you have a device, a medical device that's been used on a patient, and it's got ridges or hinges, it's wonderful to put it into the sonicator because that helps shakes up or loosens any material or debris that is on the stainless steel device. The problem with that, if it is used alone without any rinsing, is if you have a lumen and you sonicate, you will loosen the soil inside the lumen, but if you don't flush liquid through to rinse out the loosened soil, that soil just settles back down onto the surface inside the lumen. So think of sonication as a means of physically knocking the soil off the surface, and by soil I mean things like blood, protein, organisms. if you loosen their hold on the surface, you can then easily flush them out or rinse them out when you're rinsing. But if you use sonication by itself without any rinsing, you are not doing as good a job because you've loosened the soil but you haven't gotten rid of it. The next bullet is, of course, addressing the rinsing. And in that stage, you remove the loosened soil and you also are going to be removing the detergent, whether it's a chemical or an enzymatic. And the last bullet in that slide was to make a note that there are devices that do require lubrication, and lubrication is usually done after cleaning and before sterilization where needed. It's not necessary for every device every time to do lubrication. The manufacturer's guidance for that medical device will dictate how frequently you will actually do your lubrication. So that's the cleaning process. And what I've tried to do is break down some of the stages where there are important considerations that need to be kept in mind. For example, the idea of trying to get off as much gross debris as soon as possible and keeping the medical device moist until the more thorough cleaning is done. The concept that sonication is fantastic, but you must remember that once you sonicate, it's critical to then rinse off the loosened material. And with sonicators, we all know that it's really inappropriate. It's like using the same bath for 10 people in a family. If you use a sonicator all day long and it's full of crud from all the instruments that have accumulated that have been knocked off into the sonicator, it's important that the fluid inside the sonicator is changed on a regular enough basis that you're not having carryover from previous medical devices now actually soiling the devices that you're putting into the sonicator. And then finally, the concept of rinsing being critical in terms of removing both the detergent and any soil. If you go to the next slide, what I'd like to do is just walk our way through the different steps. And we all face this problem. I'm in an institution where it always happens that the physicians find a newfangled medical device, and it's in the institution being used before you even know that it's there. And the way you find out is it shows up on the doorstep of the reprocessing department, and it's kind of like, okay, clean this and send it back because we need it in 2 hours to do another procedure. And as you know, if you are given a proactive role, and there should be a proactive role, the steps that we're going to walk through are really important to identifying in your institution how to deal with each of the devices or the new devices that come on board. So step one is really the cleaning instructions. It is an obligation of manufacturers to provide validated cleaning instructions for any medical device that is being sold. And in the States, the FDA requires manufacturers to provide users with at least one or two validated cleaning methods that can be used, and also disinfection or sterilization methods that are compatible with that particular medical device. So the first step is obviously, instead of trying to come up with your own approach to cleaning, is to get from the device manufacturer their validated cleaning instructions. And that sounds so obvious, but I know, because we've been through it in our institution, sometimes trying to get that information can be a challenge. But manufacturers will usually provide you with the cleaning instructions that are appropriate for the medical device that's being used. I can't emphasize how important that is, because we've all been in the situation where there are very complex medical devices, and sometimes a channel will be forgotten in the process, whereas if you look at the manufacturer's validated cleaning instructions, it becomes very clear all the things that need to be done for that particular device to ensure that it is properly cleaned each time it is used. Now, step number two, which is the next slide, is identified as critique device. And I learned this the hard way many years ago when we were looking at the reuse of single-use sphincter tomes in Manitoba. And when you look at some of the devices, you start to appreciate that from the outside, they may look one way, but that if you look closely and you analyze the design of them, you'll find out there's sometimes channels or areas that are, you know, not initially obvious when you look at the device. So the first question to ask when you're looking at a particular device is, can patient secretions enter areas of the device that you can't visually inspect? If you see a hinge region anywhere on a medical device, or you see wires coming out of a device and there's no lure port to access to put liquid down that area, you know that device is going to get patient secretions in an area that you can't visually inspect. And the second critique or question to ask is, does the cleaning process get fluid into all those areas of the device? And those questions go together. If you look at a device and you see something that makes you feel that there's patient secretions that are going to get in a certain area, but you really think that the cleaning process isn't getting liquid into that area, then you need to stop and ask the manufacturer and double check on those things, because there are things that can create problems. And if you turn to the next slide, I've got an example of what I mean by that. And this goes back to the example I was giving you just a few seconds ago, talking about sphincter tomes. The picture in this slide, which is entitled Device Constraints That Prevent Cleaning, if you look on the left-hand side, you'll see a picture of an intact triple lumen sphincter tome. And sphincter tomes are used in gastrointestinal procedures where they're using a side-viewing duodenoscope, and they're going in to cut the tissue in the sphincter of Oddi to allow them to drain, if you will, the biliary tract, or widen it so that they can get stones out. Now, these sphincter tomes, it's interesting. If you look at that picture, you'll notice that near the handle, the top part, there are two plastic lure ports. And if you just look at this device, you would think, well, this device looks like I should be able to clean those, even though they're tiny lumens that are running down the plastic tubing, there's two lure ports there, and all I need to do is flush detergent down those and flush rinsing material, etc., and life will be fine. What isn't obviously inherent from the picture or from the device when you look at it, it is actually a triple lumen sphincter tome, and the wire which comes out at the distal end, you can see that there's an arrow in the picture. There is a wire that comes out at the very end of that little piece of plastic tubing. The channel that wire runs up goes all the way up to the handle. There is no port that allows you to access the channel that wire is in. And if you look at the diagram on the right, you'll see I'm holding a little plastic Eppendorf tube that has some red material in it. That's an example of, we took patient-used biopsy forceps, and what we did was gain access to all three lumens, and what I did was flush out from the wire channel, which normally you cannot get any fluid into, I flushed out to see after a patient procedure, does material actually get up into that channel, the one that the wire runs up in? And what's being shown in that little plastic tube is the amount of material that is up in that wire channel or can be up in that wire channel after a patient procedure. And you can see that when you first look at this biopsy or this sphincter tome, you might not appreciate the fact that patient secretions can actually go up a channel because the wire comes out and it doesn't look like an obvious channel. It just looks like it's part of the device. So that's an example. And when you go to clean this type of device, if you apply those two questions I just suggested that you apply, does patient secretion enter areas of the device you can't visually inspect? Yes, it certainly does for this sphincter tome. Does the cleaning process get fluid into all areas of the device? No, it doesn't, because we only have two ports to allow us to flush fluid down the lumens, and we know it's actually a triple lumen sphincter tome. So that's an example of a device where when you just logically look at it, you realize that cleaning such a device is going to be a challenge. Now, step number three, which is on the next slide, if you go to the next slide, it's entitled Select Detergent. Now, there is a wide array of cleaning agents that are available, and the first step in this is obviously determining whether you need a chemical detergent. There are some washer disinfectors that would recommend the use of chemical cleaning agents or chemical detergents, and obviously if you're using a device that's going to create foaming, you have to, of course, use something that's not going to foam up and cause you a lot of problems. And you will make a decision for that particular medical device whether you're going to use a chemical detergent or an enzymatic detergent. And, of course, that is going to be dictated by some of the equipment that you have available. Is the detergent compatible with your washer disinfector? Not all of them necessarily are, and you'll have to check with the manufacturer of the medical device what's recommended for use with that device. Do they recommend enzymatics or chemicals? Examples of that would be flexible endoscopes. Enzymatic detergents are the primarily recommended type of detergent to use with a flexible endoscope, whereas in some of the washer disinfectors for reprocessing surgical devices, chemical detergents are used in preference in those situations. The second bullet on that slide talks about the tap water quality, and of course this is going to affect the choice of detergent. In your reprocessing area, are you mixing your detergent, or is the machine that you're putting it in mixing it directly with tap water? And if so, is the tap water of a quality that is not going to interfere with the activity of the detergent you've selected? For example, if the water hardness in your area is very high, there are some detergents that will not function properly in hard water conditions. And then it becomes an issue whether you should be using some kind of treated water source or not in order to ensure that the detergent you're using is going to be working properly. The manufacturers of the detergents have ample material to help you make that determination and make that decision, but sometimes people don't think about this and therefore they're using a detergent that isn't working properly with the quality of water that they've actually got in their location. And the last bullet on that slide is an important one. Enzymatic detergents, generally speaking, cost a fair amount more than if you're buying a chemical detergent of some way, shape, or form. And the basis or the reason that you use an enzymatic is to allow the enzyme to digest or degrade the proteins, the fats, the carbohydrates that are present. The logic being that enzymatic degradation is going to facilitate removal of those soil components and facilitate the cleaning process. But every one of the commercially available enzymatic detergents, the manufacturer will list a minimum contact time and temperature. And when we were doing surveys across Canada, it was disconcerting to see centers that were using enzymatics because that was what was appropriate for the medical device, but the total contact time they were using was way below what the manufacturer was recommending. And essentially what they were doing was pouring their money down the drain because the enzymatic detergent was being used, but it wasn't being used for the proper contact time. Usually the minimum contact times are 3 to 5 minutes, and that's at room temperature. You must remember that enzymes are biologically active components, and they prefer to work at warmer temperatures, like body temperature. And at room temperature, yes, they work, but they're not as efficient, and therefore it is really important that the minimum contact time recommended by the manufacturer is adhered to. Usually in machines that are automated washer disinfectors, the contact time is less of an issue. It becomes more of an issue when there's manual cleaning being done, and it's usually under that circumstance where the contact time is often shortened below what is the manufacturer's recommended contact time. Now, if you move to the next slide, it's labeled Step 4, and it's dealing with rinse water. And if there's only one take-home message I give you from today's discussion, it's that when you are rinsing or using water in any way, shape, or form, the volume that's used is probably the most important parameter. So the rule of thumb for rinse water is there should be lots of it. And remember that rinsing with tap water is perfectly acceptable, and there are instances where you do need the final rinse to be of a treated quality of water that is adequate for what the device is going to be used for, but the rinsing at the pre-rinse and after the detergent stage using tap water is absolutely fine, and the idea being that it's desirable to use as large a volume of tap water as possible at any of the rinsing stages that you're using. It will only facilitate the cleaning and the removal process, and sometimes with very fragile, difficult-to-clean devices, there's a tendency not to use a lot of water when they are being rinsed because they're being cleaned manually. Whether you're cleaning manually or cleaning in an automated washer disinfector, it is important that you use a large volume of rinse water. Now, one of the considerations is obviously if you have rust or mineral deposits coming from the rinse water, it's important to get advice on how best to deal with that, whether, you know, you need to, if your water is very, very hard and it needs to be softened prior to being used. But in many places, that isn't the case, and tap water is fine, and you're not going to get any more development of rust or minerals than is expected from averagely hard tap water. And the last bullet there is the final rinse. And in some situations, it is important that the final rinse be a treated water. And by that, I mean it's had inorganic materials removed from it or some, in one way, shape, or form, been treated so that it's a better quality water that isn't going to lead to mineral deposits. And depending on what the device is going to be used for, it may have to be of a high enough quality that it even has no endotoxin present in it. And an example of that would be if you have a device that's going to be placed in the intravascular, inside the blood vessels, or intrathecally into the brain area, any device like that, you don't want residual endotoxin on it because endotoxin is lipopolysaccharide, which comes from the cell wall of a gram-negative, and it can cause pyrogenic reaction in patients. So if you have devices that are critical devices that are going to enter the vasculature, especially lumened ones, it's important that they are rinsed with a good quality treated water, such as reverse osmosis water, so that you are assured that there isn't residual endotoxin left on those devices. Again, I've put a little note at the bottom of this slide that lubrication after cleaning but before sterilization when recommended. And I'm going to give you a little anecdote because there was a situation where we had biopsy forceps that were being used in gastrointestinal procedures, and the person doing the reprocessing, these were reusable biopsy forceps, but she felt that they call it the milk bath or the lubricant, would gunk up the coil in the biopsy forceps if it was put on before sterilization. So this individual was actually steam autoclaving the reusable biopsy forceps and then dipping them in the lubricant, and then they were hung to dry and used on the patient. Now, the lubricant was made up by diluting with tap water, and you know where this story is going. What happened is the lubricant became basically a microbial bath, and that was a situation where the order in which the lubrication was done was switched. That wasn't the protocol, but it was switched because the individual was concerned that the lubricant might gunk up the coils during sterilization. So it's important to remember that lubrication is done after cleaning but before sterilization when recommended. Now, if you go on to the next slide is titled Automated versus Manual. There's a lot of move these days in especially larger healthcare facilities toward reducing the amount of manual cleaning and increasing the automation of that process. And automation is preferred. The automated washer disinfectors are preferred. And the reason for that is because of the consistency of the cycle. When you turn on a particular cycle in a washer disinfector, it's going to go through the same steps every time for every load that is put into that unit. That isn't the case when we do manual cleaning. We're all human, and sometimes we will, you know, we're in a laid-back mood and we're going to wash things for a longer period of time, and other days we're very tense or rushed and we cut down on the amount of time or the volume of fluids. And the second thing is indicated on the bullet is the automated instruments will have large volumes of fluid that are used. And by fluid, I mean the amount of water that's used for rinsing during the process. And the other thing that's very tightly controlled in the automated methods is the temperature. The water that's used is temperature controlled in many instances. And therefore, it's obvious in an automated system, what you get is a very controlled, consistent process that ensures large volumes of rinse water are used. But I'm a firm believer that you have to be very careful about that type of a statement, and that's why I put the next bullet in, that machines are only as good as their drivers. And whoever is running that automated instrument needs to be aware that just because you're putting it in an automated washer disinfector doesn't mean that machine is doing a good job unless you have done the maintenance on that machine and the documentation to show that it is functioning properly. There's nothing worse than putting something into a malfunctioning washer disinfector, and in reality, you're getting out items that might be worse off than they were before you actually put them into the washer disinfector. So it is important, if automated instruments are used, automated washer disinfectors, that they are maintained. For instance, if you're using a sonicator, it's important to have as part of your quality assurance program routine testing to make sure that the sonicator is actually working and it's doing what you think it's supposed to be doing, which is loosening the, knocking the soil off the device. Just like if you have a washing machine, you have to do monitoring to make sure that it is actually functioning properly. Now, if you go to the next slide, it's entitled Manual versus Automated Cleaning of Ported Laparoscopic Devices. Many institutions and many procedures that surgeons are using are switching more and more to the minimally invasive procedures, and they're using either laparoscopic devices or arthroscopic devices. These are long-handled surgical instruments, and the issues here are, and they've been raised many times, what is a better way to clean these types of devices? How does manual cleaning compare to automated? And I just wanted to share with you a little bit of the data, some of the data that we've generated in this area. And I'm talking in this particular case about the ability, if you will, to actually clean these devices for ported laparoscopic devices. And the only thing I'm comparing in this picture is manual versus automated. Now, if you look at the slide on the left, it's related to protein removal. You know that the patient secretions that get inside laparoscopic devices are often a high component of protein. If you look at the far left-hand side of the graph, it says positive control, and you'll notice the y-axis is absorbance percent positive control. Where it says 100%, that means we used an assay that detects protein. And if I take a soiled laparoscopic device, I put in a known amount of soil that contains blood and protein, and I measure the protein that's in it, that would be 100%. So I've got a laparoscopic device that is ported. I have tested it by sampling how much protein remains inside the inner channel of that laparoscopic device. And what I want to do is compare that to when I do manual or automated cleaning. And you'll notice the next little bar on that same graph says manual, and you'll see that it's about 25%. What that tells me is if I take a ported laparoscopic device, which has a port, I take a syringe and I fill it with my enzymatic detergent and I flush it down that port, and then I use my syringe to rinse it with tap water, and then I take a sample from inside the laparoscopic device and measure the protein, I removed 75% compared to the control, but I didn't get it all out. If I do the same thing with the same ported laparoscopic device and I put it into an automated washer disinfector, which is shown in the next little bar on that graph, and it's called auto, that's for an automated washer disinfector, you'll see that I cannot detect any protein anymore inside that laparoscopic device. And this is for a ported device, which provides optimal cleaning, whether it's manual or automated. The reason I'm showing you this data is to emphasize why the previous slide suggested that automated is preferred, because you do get more consistent removal of material, and much of that has to do with the large volume of liquid that is used in that process. If we look at the right side of that graph, it's devoted to bacterial removal. We had bacteria in that same soil, so it's the same sequence of events. You can see the positive control has about 6.5 log to the base 10 of viable organisms, and there were two that were tested, Enterococcus faecalis and Bacillus erythrophilus. So the positive control means that's how much was in that laparoscopic device if we didn't clean it. The next set of bars is how much remains after you've done manual cleaning, and that's enzymatic with fluid flow and rinsing. And you can see that, yes, you reduced the load by about 2 logs because it's now down to about 4.6 logs of organisms for both Ephicalis and B. sterothermophilus. If we put it in the automated instrument washer, which is the next one over, you'll see you do an even better job of removing the organisms. But it's pretty obvious you didn't get 100% of them out, right? There's still 2.5 to 3 logs of organisms remaining in the channel. And in both those graphs, there's a negative control to show you that if you hadn't put the soil in, the device wouldn't have organisms or protein in it. The take-home message from this slide is just experimental data to support the statement of why automated washers are preferred, simply because they do a better job than our manual ability. And that's because the fluid is being pumped through at a much faster rate than we could do manually with a syringe on a lure port. Now, if you move on to the next slide is entitled Cleaning Machine Test Methods Available for In-Hospital Use. I'm including this in here because it is important that if you have an automated washer disinfector that you're using and you want to be able to verify in your institution that it is doing the job it's supposed to be doing, it's got the right amount of fluid flow, detergent, etc., to remove material, what methods are available to users? Now, I'll state up front, I am not promoting any company or any product, but I do think it is important to make people aware of what does exist. And one of the few methods out there that is available to users for washer disinfectors to assess the cleaning ability are these TOSAI devices. They've been on the market in Europe for quite a while. They're in the States, and they're now starting to creep their way into Canada. And basically, they're little stainless steel carriers. They're a little strip of stainless steel. And if you see on the right-hand side, there's a diagram there. The strip that says number 5, you'll see there's some red bloodied material that's been layered onto the stainless steel strip. That's what the strip looks like without any cleaning. If your washer disinfector is working properly, at the end of the cycle, when you take the strip out, it should look like the one on the far right that has a 0 above it, which means all you see is a spick and span stainless steel carrier with no residual red material, no residual brown protein material. If your washer disinfector isn't working very efficiently, you'll see something like in the middle where you get a 2-3, and in that case, you've still got residual material that hasn't been cleaned off the carrier. It's a simple visual indicator of whether the cleaning is being properly done in an automated instrument reprocessor. And I'm including this in my talk just to make you aware that if you do have a desire to verify that your washer disinfectors are cleaning properly, this is one of the commercially available methods that can be used. And in North America, this is one of the few that's actually available. Now, again, your machines are only as good as your drivers and as good as the assessment you do to make sure they're working properly. If you move on to the next slide, it's entitled Issues. And the issues really are that when we have a complex device design and we are using high-level disinfection, that means we're going to end up with a low margin of safety. And an example of that would be the reprocessing of flexible endoscopes. They are very complex in their design, and currently the minimum recommended disinfection is high-level disinfection, which means we don't have the same margin of safety as we do with a steam autoclave. But the reverse also happens too. Just because a device can be sterilized using a steam sterilization method, you can get a false sense of security if you are reprocessing a complex device design. And the reason I say that is arthroscopic and laparoscopic surgical instruments are steam sterilizable. And there's a tendency then to think, oh, well, it doesn't matter. You know, as long as I get them so they look visually clean on the outside, they're going to be steam sterilized anyway, so that's fine. They're going to be sterile. But the problem is inside the lumen shaft of those devices, if you don't get good fluid flow inside them and get good cleaning inside the shaft, even if you're steam sterilizing, you can overwhelm the steam sterilizer to the point where it's no longer effectively killing organisms that are present. So to me, the issues in reprocessing are complex device design. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see that the issue there is repeated use buildup. In complex devices, what happens is you do get a buildup because these devices are used thousands of times per year. And in that graph, you would prefer that the amount of soil that you see, which is shown on the y-axis, should be as low as possible over time, which is shown on the x-axis. What happens when you have defective cleaning is shown by the graph that goes up very quickly and reaches high levels in a very short period of time. Ideally, you'd like to have that graph flat where there's no buildup over time. And what happens in reality is likely the middle line, that with repeated uses, we do get a gradual buildup. The ideal thing would be to keep the buildup as close to the lowest level as possible. And the question that's often asked is, how can this cleanliness level be assessed? And that is a problem, because right now there aren't a lot of rapid tests that can be used by users once they've done the cleaning to verify that they've adequately cleaned it. Now, if you go to the next slide, again, this is another example of sphincter tomes, and this is just some experimental data to support the concept that I've just mentioned. If you look at the, there's a picture of the sphincter tome there, and if you look at the graphs, what you'll see is the graph on the left-hand side is showing what happens in terms of residual material that is present inside a sphincter tome. It's the positive control. So the first bar that you're seeing is the positive control that is showing, in this particular case, the amount of protein that's left inside the sphincter tome if you soil it. When you manually clean it, and the first, it should be a yellow bar that you see if you're seeing it in color, or it's the middle one of that set of three, which is down at about the 40% mark. That's what happens when you clean it one time with manual cleaning. Remember, we showed you already there's some material that leaves. The next bar that's right next to it, which is now up at about 80 to 90%, that's how much soil is inside a sphincter tome that's been manually cleaned and reprocessed five times. And that sphincter tome was ethylene oxide sterilized between each of those uses, each of those repeat soiling. The take-home message here is that if you are manually cleaning, as you repeatedly use the sphincter tome, you do get a buildup of protonaceous material inside the sphincter tome. The set of bars on the right-hand side of that picture, and there's another set of three of them, the tall dark one, which goes to 100%, is the positive control, and this is using automated machine. The bar that is in between there, which is basically non-existent because it's so low, that's what happens after one use of the sphincter tome with soiling and then automated cleaning. You can't detect any protein. If you then go and use five rounds of that, that's what the next bar represents. And you can see even with the optimal method of cleaning, there is a gradual buildup that occurs. And the reason for that is these are very tiny lumens and they're very difficult to clean, and there is a gradual buildup of protein that occurs over time. So the take-home message from this slide on sphincter tomes is, if you have complex medical device design, even with optimal cleaning, there is a gradual buildup that occurs, and it is important to remember you want to keep that buildup as low as level, at as low a level as possible to prolong the life of your device. Now, if you look at the next slide, I couldn't resist this one. It's the picture of the pig looking in a container, and the current benchmarks for cleaning are really that it's visibly clean. And the question that I raise here is, what is realistic? In many of the complex medical devices we now have to deal with, we can't even see inside the tiny lumens or inside the device to know if it is clean or not. So it's one thing to say visible clean. It's hard to actually deal with that. And what I'm going to do now is switch gears, and I'm going to go through some different areas where I think there are cleaning issues that need to be identified. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see it headed as general surgery. Here we have surgical instruments that have hinges and serrated edges, and this is by and large probably the bulk of what gets processed through in terms of general surgery. In this instance, it's obviously the hinge areas and the serrated edges that need special attention during the cleaning process. If you go to the next slide, it is entitled Orthopedic Surgery, and I've included this one in here because I don't know about your institution, but we have recently gone through a number of issues related to bone reamers that are used in orthopedic surgery and the frustration in dealing with how to properly clean these devices. Now, I'm showing you a picture on the right-hand side of that slide of two bone reamers. The one on the very bottom, you can see, I didn't get some really good close-up shots, but the point is that one on the bottom is actually a coil that is wound around, and obviously the bone reamer itself is quite flexible because you can see that the hand there is flexed it around completely. The bone reamer that's above it is one of the more rigid type of bone reamers that's a solid formation. There is another set of bone reamer that has got a flat coil that goes around it. The take-home message is any of the ones that have the coil around them, whether it's a rope coil or whether it's a flat type of coil, it's extremely difficult when you flex them to actually get in between each of those cracks and clean them. And the picture I show you on the left, where it says bone reamers, there's a picture of a test tube with a swab in it. If you see the little black pieces of crud in there, those were bits that came out after we had processed a bone reamer in the best manner possible, and visually we could actually see material still in between the coiled regions, and we went in with a moistened swab, and that crud that you see there actually came out from in between the rungs of the bone reamer. Now, I don't know about you, but if they were doing my hip, I sure wouldn't want that piece of junk sitting inside one of my bones, even if that bone reamer had gone through the steam sterilizer. And what happened in our institution was that the surgical surgeons and the reprocessing people looked at this. There are multiple different types of bone reamers available, and what they opted to do was to stop using the ones that have these coils that are so difficult to clean, and they went to the solid shaft type of bone reamer, the ones that are malleable, they have a bit of flex in them. And those ones are much more easy to clean because they're solid shaft formation. They don't have this coil that's a nightmare. We tried everything with the bone reamers, and we couldn't come up with what would be considered an acceptable method that visually, even visually, didn't get them clean. So in orthopedic surgery, if you're doing orthopedic surgery or you use things like bone reamers, this is an area where the reprocessing personnel and infection control people really need to look closely to make sure that what's being done is adequate to get the level of cleaning that we all assume is being done. If you flip over to the next slide, cardiovascular surgery is another area. There in Canada, we still do quite a bit of reuse of single-use items, and the balloon catheters used in the cardiovascular surgical procedures, the cardiovascular procedures, I should say, are of big concern. This diagram, I'm showing you a balloon catheter, and you can see it on the left. It's a very thin catheter that threads into the vasculature, and on the right is a blow-up of the distal end, and you'll see, I hope you can appreciate, a thin membrane. It's a balloon that is inflated, and that's what's used to enlarge the blood vessel diameter and to open it up so that blood flows through better. Now, this is the kind of device where it would be absolutely critical that if such a thing was being reprocessed, that it obviously is rinsed in a way to prevent pyrogens from being present. In my opinion, I don't think there ever should be balloon catheters that are reprocessed or reused, and my reason for saying that is I don't think they can be adequately cleaned and rinsed in a way that would be equivalent to the original manufacturer's specifications. So I raise this as an issue of reprocessing, and again, it's for single-use devices that I don't think should be done because of the difficulty in actually achieving it. If you flip to the next slide, you'll see it's entitled Flexible Endoscopy. And in flexible endoscopy, although critical devices pose the highest risk of infection transmission, you have to remember that even the flexible endoscope itself, even though it's a semi-critical device, if you look at the picture, you'll see I've put in there a side-viewing ERCP scope, the distal end, and you can see the little lever. It's a very complex distal end, and patient secretions most certainly can go up all of the channels in a flexible endoscope. And in addition to that, there are the accessory devices like the sphincterotome that we've talked about, the biopsy forceps. In Canada, we still do reprocess a lot of these, and I think you've got to realize that these biopsy forceps and the sphincterotomes are critical devices, and they do need the proper level of cleaning and sterilization before they're used on the next patient. And it's important that if we choose to do that, that in the institution that is doing it, that there is a validated reprocessing protocol. And those are very difficult to develop because they require a lot of stringent control on the cleaning part of it. And I couldn't resist the next slide. This was a cartoon drawn by a graduate student that was listening to one of my talks, and I think it summarizes very nicely the take-home message from the previous slide, and that's really that endoscopes are problematic, and that's got to do with the complexity of the design and the need to clean every one of those channels, rinse every one of those channels, and make sure that they get adequately exposed to either high-level disinfectant or low-temperature sterilization methods. If you go on to the next slide, there is laparoscopic surgery is the title that's given on this one. And the issue in laparoscopic surgery is to check to see whether the laparoscopic accessory devices, like these hinged graspers, have a port that allows you to flush the long shaft or not. If there is no port, they're very difficult to clean unless you do retroflushing. The next slide shows laparoscopic device cleaning, a validation study that we actually did as one of our research projects. And I just want to draw your attention to the retroflushing adapter and the fact that these are useful if you have laparoscopic devices that don't have ports, because it means you cannot flush liquid down the long shaft. So if it's non-ported, you really do need to have a retroflush adapter, because what that does, you put the distal end of the laparoscopic device into it, and then you flush the rinse liquid and the detergent upwards into the shaft and out. And that's the only way to get fluid flow in a non-ported laparoscopic device. The next slide is to show you again some data to support that comment, and it's the effect of cleaning, a sonication on the cleaning of protein from a laparoscopic device. And I'll go through it very quickly, but if you look on the left side, it says A, non-ported, no fluid flow. Look at the positive control, and you'll see there's 100% protein absorbance, which means we have lots of protein in that laparoscopic device if it's not cleaned. The next bar represents how much protein remained if we only took the laparoscopic device, sonicated it, but didn't have any fluid flow. This supports what I was saying earlier. Without fluid flow, you don't flush out the loosened material, and you can see you didn't do much to remove that protein. It's still there. If, on the other hand, you look on the far right-hand side where it says ported, you will notice that the positive control shows 100%. If we have a port that is flushing fluid through at the same time it's being sonicated, you will see that you have 0% protein left inside that shaft of the laparoscope, because what was loosened was flushed out. And again, a negative control is just included to show that if we had not soiled those devices, we wouldn't have any detectable protein. So if you turn to the next slide, it says, so what if cleaning is suboptimal? What's the problem? Well, the problem is there's very well documented instances of infection transmission when flexible endoscopes are suboptimally cleaned, and because that leads to inadequate disinfection. There's also mounting evidence to suggest that with arthroscopic accessory devices, not the arthroscopes, but the accessory devices, the long shafted ones, there can be increased infection rate associated with these if they're not properly cleaned. There was a poster at APIC that showed they had arthroscopic accessory devices where the cleaning was suboptimal and they used flash sterilization, and they noticed an increased infection rate in their arthroscopic procedures. And although there couldn't be a cause and effect link, it did look as if that had contributed to increased infection rates. And then the final bullet there is, as we know, in instances such as brain surgery, if you do have somebody that has CJD and they have had invasive brain surgical procedures, if those devices aren't properly cleaned, the prion material may remain on there, and we know that many of the sterilization methods that we currently use will not kill the prion. So the important thing, again, is to make sure that obviously with CJD, if you have a known case, you would not reuse those brain surgical medical devices. But I want to bring it in here to emphasize the need for proper cleaning to remove material. If you go to the next slide, the value of cleaning verification for users, the bad news is that other than those proper function tests that can be used in washing machines like the TOSAI devices, there's not a lot else that's available for users to use to ensure they've got adequate cleaning. There would be value for that if they were available, because it would help with training, et cetera. Now, I want to close with the next slide. This issue of adequate cleaning and reprocessing is being recognized, and guidelines are currently being worked on to try to address this issue. The Europeans, the CEN, ISO, they are working towards standard tests for users to use to validate or verify in their institution cleaning. And the AMI guideline document group is also working at guidelines for manufacturers, and they're recommending that manufacturers help provide rapid tests for users. Because the big question is obviously how clean is clean enough, and if users don't have test methods, it's very difficult for them to know if they're doing a good job or not. If you go to the second last slide, which is the next one, in summary, I hope these were the take-home messages that you were able to get out of today's session, that device complexity has a huge impact on cleaning issues. You know that already, but it's the ability to properly assess the complexity and make sure that you're criticizing and making sure that you are doing a good job of the cleaning of these complex devices, and that in the second bullet, you want to ensure the proper process is in place, not just one step of it. The entire process is put in place to deal with what are very complex devices. And the third bullet is that the equipment that's used for cleaning really needs to be optimal in its cleaning capacity. It needs to be monitored for functionality, and that sonication needs fluid flow. Those are all important things around equipment. It's not a panacea that just because you're putting it in a sonicator, it's cleaning. It isn't unless you do flushing. The fourth bullet is manufacturers do have responsibilities to provide you with appropriate validated cleaning protocols. And the very last bullet, fluid flow, fluid flow, fluid flow. If there's one thing you get, it's that use lots of fluid when you're doing the cleaning. And I'm going to close, if you can go to the very last slide. And I'm sorry if I sound like a pedantic mother, and I hope you don't feel as if you're drowning in cleaning issues, because sometimes that's how we feel when we get talks like this and we realize there's so many issues to deal with. And on that note, I'm going to stop.
Well, Michelle, thank you very much for yet another fantastic presentation. Great information, well delivered. And thank you to everyone who has joined us today. And we'll talk again soon. Goodbye.